This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Aquarium Mania. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Anong, speaking to you from the University of Florida, IFAS, Tropical Aquaculture Laboratory. Thanks for joining us. Freshwater fish keepers have thousands of fish to choose from. But for more experienced aquarists, among the prized gems are the discus. Known by many as the king of the aquariums, these denizens of the Amazon are calm, stately, and, in addition to a unique disc shape, available in beautiful wild-type and aquaculture colors and patterns. My guest today, Kapil Mandrekar, a lifelong aquarist, ichthyologist, and conservationist currently working with Project Piaba, has a special appreciation for and expertise with discus. Join us as Kapil shares his life story and explains why discus are worthy of their regal title. We'll be right back after these messages.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Aquarium Mania on Pet Life Radio. My guest today is Kapil Mandrekar, ichthyologist, lifelong aquarist, and conservationist with Project Piaba. Thanks for joining us, Kapil.
Thank you for having me.
So I usually like to start kind of getting a little personal with my guests. Let's talk a little bit about some of your early years. I've heard some of the stories, but I'd love to hear them or maybe more. How did you first become interested in fish in aquariums?
Well, when I was born, my father brought me home to a house of aquariums. He actually rebuilt the stands of the tank so they're closer to the floor. So I actually was able to interact with them as a younger child. And then when my parents moved to Kalamazoo, Michigan, my dad joined the Southwest Michigan Aquarium Society. So I was about 3 years old at that time. And I used to go to each of those meetings with him. And I learned a lot more about fish. I became more fascinated about fish. I learned where they came from, and it just became a passion of mine.
So, yeah, I was kind of curious. Your dad had a bunch of aquariums or was really interested. Do you know how he got interested when he was in India?
So my dad told me that when he was a young child, he used to get the bowl, the glass parts for, a light bulb, like a big, one of those big street lamp light bulbs. And he used to take the electrical part off of it, and he used to go to the beach and catch larval marine fish, and he would put them in his room and watch them for the day that they would survive. And then back in the day, you know, those big water jugs that you kind of put on the receptacles that give you water, back then they were glass, and somebody gave him one of those, and I think he graduated to getting guppies in one of those, but they got algified, and eventually I think a family friend or one of his uncles was able to get him a fish tank. And that's kind of where he started. And then when he was a little bit older, he wanted a bigger tank. And my grandfather told him if he wanted a bigger tank that he needed to build one. And he built tanks. And those a couple of those tanks, I believe, were holding water till about like 10 or 15 years ago till somebody broke them. So, yeah, that's kind of how I got into the aquariums, which sort of transferred over to me.
That's awesome. Can you describe the very first tank you can remember, you know, size, what kind of fish you had, even maybe filtration, if you remember that?
So I still have these tanks. Sort of the first sort of two tanks that I remember my dad having were these two acrylic 55-gallon aquariums. One was like a community tank with, tetras, barbs, gouramis, angelfish. The other one was actually a goldfish tank with, various fancy goldfish. I believe there were a couple of shabunkins in there. And then, my dad, I think, had a couple of smaller tanks, had a couple of smaller tanks where he would, breed some fish. That was I guess my earliest memory of that and that was back when we lived in apartments. When we moved into a house, my father's dream was to have a fish tank in the wall. So the 255s actually went into the wall, and we actually built a 240-gallon tank several years later to fill that void in the wall. And then we started a fish room on the other side of the wall. And I think we had originally had like 10 tanks, and maybe by the time that I graduated high school, there were about 40 tanks. We had a indoor pond and we had several outdoor ponds. So we got really into it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And obviously it helps that your dad was really into it. Was your mom into it or, as well, hopefully?
What's actually really funny is when my parents, when they first came to this country, were living in Ohio. And when they moved from Ohio to Michigan, my dad didn't actually want to set up the fish tank, and my mom was the one that actually wanted it. So, but no, she wasn't as into the fish. She, I think, liked the aesthetics of the one in the wall, but my mom's always been very supportive of my aquarium hobby, and both my parents have just sort of let me go literally wild with my love for fish and pets.
That's awesome. Now, obviously, you've got a lot of experience and education, with fisheries and fish. Can you share some of your studies and experience during your college years and what maybe influenced you the most?
Yeah, I think one important experiences that I had when I was in college was as I did a lot of undergraduate research. And I first started, I worked with a professor on sort of habitat selection in secondary cavity nesting birds, particularly like little house wrens and tree swallows. And then it wasn't till a few years later, a couple years later, that I had contacted some researchers and graduate students at the University of Michigan, and that sort of evolved into a summer research experience. And that was my first experience with fish. I worked in the Museum of Zoology, and I worked primarily on Ampelophagus storkii, which is a Mitis cichlid that's endemic to Lake Opoyo, and I really looked at their behavior and their aggression. The cichlids in the wild are not super aggressive, but when we brought them into captivity, they would become more aggressive, especially the smaller the space, the more aggressive they would become. And what I really looked at is what are some aspects of their aggression. So I tried to look in, territorial disputes. Was it prior residence? If a fish was there beforehand, if he cleared to claim the territory. And then the following summer, I had a NSF funded REU, and I went to Arkansas State University. I worked with Dr. Romero there, and we worked on cavefish. And then I started doing some more, taxonomy work with some of the North American cavefish. And this experience with the University of Michigan morphed into another research experience after I graduated from college on a Mexican cichlid called Charictis minkley, which is this polymorphic cichlid, meaning it actually has three different feeding morphologies, and it's found in this small desert valley called Quatre Ciénegas. And that was my first sort of field expedition to do research somewhere else. And so those were the three primary, research experiences on fish that I had before I entered graduate school.
So I'm just curious, with the Midas, what were your findings or what was the aggression trigger?
So it seemed that, if there was a three-dimensional structure in there, that the fish seemed to have more prior residence in there to be more aggressive.
Okay. And then with your field studies, those are definitely like all genetically the same, I guess, or it's definitely
yeah, yeah. So they originally they were going to be, it was considered that there was sympatric speciation going in, and further studies revealed that it's all one species, and there's these three feeding morphologies. There's a piscivorous one, there's a molluscivore, and then there's a detritivore. And they all live in these spring-fed pools that look like little oases in the desert.
Yeah, that's pretty significant variation. That's pretty cool. So now, obviously, you decided to go a little further with your studies and go to grad school. What kind of was your decision to do that and where to go? And maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, your work there, because I know I think it's with one of my favorite fish. So
what I really wanted to do is I really wanted to travel with grad school. And I think that probably sort of dictated my looking for places. I guess if I were to give a young person advice, I would say go after, the question more than this place. But so I was looking at, mostly faculty members at different schools that were working abroad. And I was kind of going back and forth, wanting to study sort of more theoretical evolutionary biology of fishes versus, more ecology and conservation biology of fishes. I decided that I wanted to kind of go more down the path of ecology. And I met my advisor at a conference. And I think what really amazed me and this sort of kind of helped lead me to Project Piaba was I worked on this fish, one of the largest freshwater fish with scales. It's a giant arapaima, and they are found in the Amazon and Essequibo River basins. They can attain a length up to, I think, 9 to 10 feet, I think, are some of the largest ones found. I would say in the wild today, most of the ones you tend to find tend to be around that 6 to 8 feet range. But this fish was historically extirpated throughout most of its range. It has a very tasty meat, and being such a large fish, half the weight of the fish is its fillet. So, and they command, let's just say, a price in their currency probably is equivalent to what we would pay for a wild-caught Alaskan salmon here. And so it's a very valuable fish, and it's really in demand. And in the, 60s, 70s, some community started realizing that a lot of these, commercial fishermen were coming into these communities and they were wreaking havoc. And so the community sort of made a stand, and this resulted in conflict between these commercial fishermen and these artisanal fishermen. And the government became involved, and the courts ruled that, the resources on these communal lands belong to the communities and not to the public. So this sort of stemmed this community-based management of different resources, particularly arapaima. And in these areas that these communities lived and fished these fish, that's where arapaima populations were rising. They eventually started working with scientists, and they started setting size limits, seasons, and arapaima are an air-breathing fish, so they have to surface like a whale to breathe every so often. And so every time they come to breathe, they come up and they make a giant splash and gulp air. And sometimes it sounds like a missile going off. And when you're in you're in the jungle with a lake full of these animals, it's pretty incredible to see. They can sit on shore on these lakes and count them. So how the ecology of a lot of fish in the Amazon works, particularly arapaima, is you have a dry season and you have a flooded season. In the dry season, you have a river channel, and arapaima do not live in the main river channel. And then you have these peripheral of these other aquatic habitats that are connected by channels. There's floating meadows. There's oxbow lakes. And these arapaima tend to like deeper oxbow lakes. During the flooded season, water levels rise, in some areas it goes up 10, 15 plus, feet into the jungle and the forest flood. And that's a period of time where fish like to reproduce and use the forest as nursery. And that's when arapaima, which use parental care similar to cichlids, build a nest, lay their eggs, and then they protect their young for a fairly long period of time. And so with this, in these, what amazed me is in these areas where humans were living was actually where the population of Arapaima was growing. And in one part in the central western Amazon, the Mamirawa Reserve, the populations just skyrocketed to a point at which that little reserve actually had more fish in it than the rest of the Amazon. So and I think what really attracted me to the Arapaima is this sort of this relationship humans had with nature.
So what were your specific like kind of studies with them, or what were you looking at?
So I'm still working on publishing some of these studies, but I was looking at their diet. I was looking at their sort of trophic ecology using isotopes, looking at food webs, and really looking at how, management can affect the ecology of these fish, but really trying to figure out within this region what were the main nutritional sources, what are they eating, does it sort of change through, does it change through different management protocols?
Okay. So before we start talking about discus, maybe a little bit more on kind of like the your current status. Actually, what is your day job before we talk about more of your kind of fishy parts?
My day job, I'm a US spy. No, I am a consultant. I'm an independent consultant. I work with different aspects of the pet industry as well as Project Piaba, where I work with the fisheries and the trade of the cardinal tetras.
And so I know you've done a lot of different things. You mentioned working at as an aquarist, kind of doing aquaculture as well and research. What kind of things do you think in those specific jobs kind of helped you the most, or do you have any specific take homes or stories for all the experiences you've had?
Oh man, I would like to say I'm a jack of all trades, but a master of none. I think that working within aquaculture, the aquarium trade, the thing, they've all had sort of different aspects of, the trade of fish and the biology of fishes. But I wouldn't say any one thing really sticks out to me. Working in the commercial aquaculture of fish, I think was pretty interesting. I worked with seahorses, and it really, to understand some of the reproduction and getting, it's not in a sense like a hobbyist level where you're trying to get some babies, but you have to be able to get enough babies. You have to get survival, and you start learning stuff about the biology of these fish, and it sometimes becomes like second nature to you. When you look at them, you can, I don't even know how to say it. I'm like, oh, I need to tweak this a little bit. It's I like to say that, I could explain to you how to raise, these seahorses in a biological terms, but there's a little bit of finesse that you sort of have to develop in an experience that you have to have before you can actually be successful with it.
Yeah, no, I know definitely what you mean. A last question before the discus. So you've joined Project Piaba. Can you tell us a little bit about your role with Project Piaba? And I think some of our listeners should be familiar with it, but maybe just a real brief intro.
So Project Piaba is an organization that started in the late 80s, early 90s. It was started by Dr. Chow and Mr. Scott Dowd, and it sort of stemmed off of a research project that there were a lot of aquarium fish, particularly cardinal tetras, coming out of the Rio Negro. Originally, it was thought that this fishery would have a negative effect on the ecosystem and fish populations. And after Dr. Chow, who was, I believe, a faculty at IMPA then, he IMPA is the basically the Amazon Institute. It's a universe that focuses just on Amazonian science, conservation, culture, that. And so he did some of the first studies in the Rio Negro basin and sort of discovered that actually these fisheries are not harming population, that they're actually not even touching the surface of how many fish can be collected sustainably. And the fishery actually protects the ecosystem. These aquarium fish collectors have developed a traditional knowledge that they really understood that in order for their fishery to be strong, that they need to protect the forest, and the fish depend on the forest. And so these fish are sort of become the guardian of the forest. So Project Piaba was created to sort of support that trade, help whether it be in Brazil or abroad, and help encourage the purchase of these wild-caught fish from the Rio Negro and educate people on the benefits that they have. I'm actually, I think actually we're December is my 1 year anniversary with Project Piaba, so I'm pretty new to that. My main role at, so everybody at Project Piaba wears many different hats. It's a small organization, so we're doing all sorts of things with it, but I am working sort of as a marketing specialist, so I'm working within the US of sort of how to promote these fish, help educate the public in the United States about this fishery, help aquarium shops, wholesalers appropriately sell and educate people about these fish.
Okay.
As a biologist, I'm also doing stuff, you know, in the field with the biology of these fish and you know, working all different aspects of the trade. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating, and the Amazon's, obviously amazing. Let's talk about Discus, and we'll have you do a little bit of an intro before we take a break. So, putting your ichthyologist hat on, can you maybe just give us some maybe a general overview of Discus from your viewpoint?
Yeah, so discus are a type of cichlid. It's a round fish, why it has the name discus. They are found in sort of lowland regions of the Amazon. And currently, there's three described species of discus. There is Symphysodon heraldi, which is, you know, considered to be the blue or brown discus. There's Symphysodon discus, which is the Haeckel discus, which is primarily found in the Rio Negro region, and the region that Project Piaba supports the fishery in. And then there's a couple of other disjunct populations of that. And then there is the green discus, which is Symphysodon tarsu, which is found in the central and western Amazon. There are some areas between the blue discus, the Haeckel discus, where there are hybrid zones of those, where the two species do hybridize. And there was a paper, another paper that's come out. So there's been three kind of sort of papers that really focus in the recent years. When I say recent, it's been a while now. But I think it's coming on like close to 20 years when these papers were published. But there's another paper that sort of looked at just the genetics of these fish, and they identified five evolutionary significant units in the populations of discus. So they looked at, you know, the green discus were their own thing, the Haeckel discus were their own thing and related to the other disjunct populations. And then with the blue discus, which is the Symphysodon heraldi, those fish, they sort of categorize in two different units of population. There's sort of the blue unit, then there's the brown unit. Before we kind of go too much into this further, but just to just make a thing on color, discus fish, these are just like kind of like a general thing. Discus fish are highly variable in the wild and, you know, within a population can range in colors. And then they discovered a fifth unit, which is the Rio Xingu. The discus of Rio Xingu are sort of their own thing. So it seems that the Heraldi could potentially be split up into two species genetically, and the Xingu discus could be also a new species. But in order to describe a fish, one has to do a morphological comparison as sort of the primary. So you can't just describe a fish on genetics. The morphology, the meristics, you know, those are all the scale counts, you know, looking at shape, size, looking at, you know, the fin ray counts. Those are all really important aspects to actually describing a fish.
Well, great. And I'm going to definitely have some follow-ups to that, and we'll talk more about discus and discus keeping. But let's take a short break, and we'll continue our discussion with ichthyologist, aquarist, and conservationist Kapil Mandrekar after a word from our sponsors.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms, and our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
We're back and continuing our conversation with my guest, Kapil Mandrekar, ichthyologist, aquarist, and conservationist with Project Piaba. So you gave us a really good intro and started getting into some of the genetics and variation in the wild. I mean, it sounds obviously kind of complicated, but interesting as well. I'm just curious about the Xingu population. So is that not really closely related to the other three you had mentioned?
Yeah, it's sort of its own unit. You know, it looks very similar to like a brown discus. They're not necessarily the most colorful population of discus, but they're also just a very unique one. And I have seen them in I've never seen them in the wild, but I have seen them in aquaria before.
Okay. This may be a question before your age and time. Do you know when discus first kind of got into the hobby, or are you familiar with any of that?
Yeah, so I believe discus, the Heckel discus was, I think, discovered in the 1800s. And then in the early 1900s is when a second species was discovered, which was described as, I believe, Symphysodon aquafasciatus, which that name is no longer considered valid. But that sort of lumped, you know, the basically there was Heckel discus and everything else was this other discus. Discus, I believe, were first imported in, I don't know if it was Europe or the U.S., but they're first imported in the Western world in the 1920s. And I don't think it was till maybe the 1930s when some actually might have survived.
Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, that was my next question.
And then I don't think it was until the 50s that we started seeing people breeding them in captivity. And I don't think it was till the 60s or 70s till we started getting more commercial breeding of those discus. And in the 80s and 90s is when, you know, real commercial discus took off. And there's multiple millions of discus born and traded a year throughout the world.
So before we talk a little bit more about aquaculture discus and, you know, and kind of discus keeping, what are the processes by which discus are kind of collected in the wild? I know you've kind of been out there. How does that happen?
So when I was doing my work on Arapaima, I was in the lower Amazon, and there was the lower Amazon is also sort of like the focal point of where the blue and brown discus occur, particularly the blue discus. While I was there, I really wanted to, my goal was to swim with discus in the wild. And there was one exporter there called Santanim Discus, run by Victor Charisma. And, you know, I got in contact with him and I became friends with him and I started going out to these places. One thing I can tell you is that the variety of habitats is pretty incredible that discus come from. But really, you know, like the Arapaima, there's various communities that focus on collecting the discus. Some of these communities, not everybody that you know collect discus, but there's a group of people that, you know, focus on discus collection, and they collect the discus, you know, in two ways. They sort of put nets out by fallen branches, trees, you know, at night they seem to come up into those, and it's usually, I believe, in the evening where they go and they sort of you know, use between seines and a specialized dip net, they collect the discus. And then the discus are kept in a floating cage, which can either be made out of just wood planks, or some of them are, you know, more like a cage really made out of a plastic netting material. And they are held in those environments for a period of time before the exporter comes and takes them. Now, there is, like I said before, discus are highly variable. I would say the Heckel discus are probably the least variable, but within the blue discus populations, the populations are highly variable. And I say this because, you know, I would see these collections of wild discus. You know, I would say like Curipera is one place that I went to. Curipera is really well known because the discus are very red from that region. And it's probably one of the most highly sought after populations of wild discus. But you would see these discus that would say Curipera Royal, which means, you know, is a fish that's fully striated and has, you know, the blue or iridescent turquoise coloration on it. Then they would have, you know, Curipera Semi-Royals, which would be, there'd be patches of this blue striation, but it wouldn't cover the full body. And then you would have, you know, solid Curiperas, you know, they're called Curipera Reds, which is a solid red fish. And those guys would may have some striations on the fin or the head area, but, you know, it would be a solid, you know, reddish brown rich color. And, you know, at first I thought, you know, these fish, there must be one lake that they're all solids, one lake that they're semis, one lake that they're royals. And when I got there, I realized they all live together. And there's some fish in those populations that are not the prettiest fish, you know, that don't have that solid red coloration. So within the fish, so the fishermen try to do their best job, you know, weeding out what is desirable by the aquarium trade. And then when the exporter goes there, he goes and he picks out the fish and, you know, sees if it's acceptable. They literally, like, we literally bag the fish and put them in a styrofoam box and take them on a boat or a train back to the city where they're acclimated and conditioned for export.
So you kind of answered part one of my next questions, which was, so you think it's probably genetic and not so much just diet that leads to the coloration?
I think there's a variety of different things that lead to sort of the coloration. So there, yes, there is a genetic component. I do also see that there's a sexual selection component in some of the areas. You know, like you'll find discus, usually the discus are in black or clear water, but, you know, there are areas where discus are found in murky waters. You find discus found in pH of like 4.58, you know, to neutral water. Usually they tend to be in various areas a little bit softer than 7, but that does occur. So there's some of that. And then there's also some stuff with just habitat and color. So I think there's a lot of things selecting the coloration of these fish. But I think in some of these areas, it's a combination of mate selection. And at least in the clear areas, there's a combination of mate selection and, you know, camouflage in the habitat, which I think a couple different colorations probably work really well. But and in Curipera, the water is just murky. It's more closer to the neutral range. The temperatures where discus range can be in the upper 80s to, you know, the mid 70s. Curipera is probably in that 70 to 80 degree range. You know, it's very turbid water. Curipera, you know, is still connected to the Amazon river. You know, it's what they call like a terra firm lake, which terra firm means, so you have two different sort of land type of habitats on the rivers. You have what we call the Varzia, which is the Amazonian floodplain. And then you have what we call terra firm, which is, you know, sort of solid land that occurs next to the river. So the floodplain habitat is what floods, as well as is highly variable. It's a very silty, muddy sort of habitat that, you know, can change every year with the change in season. But a terra firm is actually like a solid land. It's not a silt, it's not a mud. There's, you know, there's a more ancient geological component to that land. So that's kind of where those fish were occur.
Okay.
I don't want to go too far into this, but, like, you know, one area which was the Tapajos River, that was actually the first place that I collected discus. And that actually, I didn't go out with Victor. There was a undergraduate student that was working on the Arapaima project with us, and he told me about this friend he had that collected fish for the local aquarium trade, and he was going to go out collecting discus with him. And I go, oh, I want to go. And so, you know, we meet at the shopping mall in the local city. He picks us up in his car and he takes us, you know, to the port area. And in Santarém, there's this giant fish market. You can look up Santarém fish market. In the wet season, dolphins come up there, and it's this place in the city. And it's not necessary, since it is in an urban area, it's not like the cleanest place. There's a lot of trash there. There's sewage outflow into this area. You know, we get in the beach, and I was just like, where's the boat that we're going on? And the fisherman goes, oh, there's no boat. We're going to collect them here. And I go to him, I'm not getting in the water here. And he's like, oh, no. I just need you to grab the fish for me when I bring them in. And, you know, in this, I would say, polluted area, very heavily urban, we were collecting discus, you know, of all different sizes there, as well as a variety of other fish. And I think at this point I had spent, you know, a couple of years in going back and forth from Brazil and always wondering where the discus lived. And I walked by this fish market almost on a daily, and I was like, man, they're kind of everywhere. So, and then the third area I went to is a place called Lago Grande, which is sort of this spring-fed sort of river system that flows into these lakes. And the water there is a lot cooler. It's very acidic. The water is crystal clear. That's the site that I got to swim with the discus. And, you know, come to find out, too, the discus seemed to like a lot of flow, which is very, very unique to what we think that they need in captivity. But they seem to be found in deeper water with lots of flow near some sort of woody material, whether it be driftwood or tree branches. And it was incredible to see them, you know, swim very, very swiftly in the current.
So when you say heavy flow, do you mean just for that area or do you mean in general?
Just in that area of the river, you know, you have these areas. But yeah, the one area that I was swimming with them in Lago Grande, the flow was so heavy that I actually had to grab onto the driftwood that was sort of stuck into the ground there in order to stay, or else I would have just flowed away.
That's amazing. That's definitely a lot more variety than I realized. So I guess maybe we can combine some of my next questions. Obviously, as you mentioned, there's been a lot more aquaculture, and I've seen a lot of I remember when pigeon bloods first came out, and there's a lot of kind of variety. Can you maybe talk a little bit about the variety in colors of the cultured species, and then maybe talk a little bit about how, like, keeping wild type versus the aquacultured species, like, may differ? Like, what would, you know, hobbyists have to think about?
Okay. So I remember, you know, in the 90s, when we were starting to see discus come in from Asia, culture in Asia, that were very colorful, and then you would see wild discus were still pretty strongly coming into the United States, that, you know, the wild discus used to just be these ugly brown ones, and they weren't that nice looking. Part of that is the supply chain. I think that on both captive as well as wild discus, the supply chain changed on those. But part of it was the supply chain, and part of it is the American market wasn't buying the pretty discus because they cost more money. The American market wanted the cheapest discus, and so the really unique and really the prettier population, the discus, were going to Asia and then Europe, and we were hardly getting any of these populations. So when I show pictures of wild discus, you know, you see a full royal discus, which, you know, you can say looks somewhere like a red turquoise, you know, blue turquoise, or, you know, brilliant turquoise in that realm. Like, that's something that it does occur frequently in the wild. And the reason we don't really see that is because we never got them in the United States, and they went to various collectors and breeders in other parts of the world. The solid red fish is probably where the Marlboro discus might have come in from. You see that. You do see with the snakeskin pattern of discus, you know, which are very characteristic of a lot of very little bands, just very, very tightly spun striations. But those guys, that color pattern is something that is sort of like a mutation that does occur in some wild population discus, but it's not a frequent one. But that's I believe where that mutation sort of possibly came from. With blue diamonds, which is a solid, you know, baby blue discus, those I think stemmed from there are blue diamond discus that do occur in the wild. Again, like the snakeskin, it's, you know, this mutation that's not very common, that occurs every so often, and I believe the blue diamonds were line bred out of those. The most difficult discus to breed are the Heckel discus. Part of that reason is they are from more acidic regions. In my opinion, they're one of the prettiest of the wild discus. They're probably the most common wild discus that came into the hobby. But I don't think when they were first being exported, I don't think we knew the best about the supply chain of those. But those are probably the most difficult wild discus to breed. They do hybridize in the wild with the blue or brown discus, and they do hybridize with the captive strains of discus. So, you know, you can find what we have are Heckel crosses. Also, with some of the solid red discus, we've sort of created a couple of different strains of those, like Red Covers and Red Rose, which sort of stem from some of these, you know, brown discus. And some of them, sometimes you are seeing wild crosses in some of the captor strains of discus. So that's pretty unique.
A quick follow-up. So I'm guessing, obviously, all the hybrids are fertile, right?
I think there's question of whether the hybrids between Heckles and Blue are fertile.
Okay.
Or not, but right now they're considered the same species, which is the blue-brown discus, but I believe between those populations, they are able to breed. I am not 100% certain on, I assume that the green discus might have been hybridized in with some of that. That's where you kind of, I'm unclear in which, if some of the spotted discus that we see in captivity have some of those green discus in there, because the green discus tend to have a lot more spotting in them. So I'm unclear if that's that case or not, but generally there is some level of fertility between the populations. And I don't know of anybody that's bred the Xingu discus in captivity. I just don't think they are as heavily traded as other populations of discus. I think in the Xingu, they mainly focus on Laura Koreans or your Pleco type fish, as well as they're not the most colorful discus.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about discus keeping, and are they really for more advanced hobbyists? And what do you recommend, wild caught versus aquacultured? Obviously, there's going to be pluses and minuses, and as well as like sort of just general kind of requirements for keeping them.
I will say the ease of the discus really, I think, depends whether it's wild or aquacultured is sort of, has it gone through a good supply chain? In the past, I think discus were considered these, you know, expert level fish, difficult to keep. And I think part of that was to the fact that we weren't properly shipping these fish across the country. You know, they were putting several in, you know, a big bag and shipping them across. You know, we didn't really know as much about these fish, and that's definitely have changed. What I think a lot of these exporters in Brazil in particular have discovered is that the fish need to rest between each stop before they can be shipped out. And you know, they work on doing various treatments there. And primarily what they actually condition these fish with is salt. You know, they bring these discus in and they salt them. And that's usually the biggest medication that they use. It's kind of difficult to get most fish medications in Brazil. So that's usually the big thing with those guys. And with same thing with the captive farm discus is, you know, they just weren't sending them very well for a long period of time. So those have changed. I think there's been sort of with the onset of these aquaculture discus, wild discus trade sort of dropped. And I think in the past 10 years, it's been climbing back up with a lot more popularity in social media of wild discus. And you're starting to see wild discus crosses. And I'm starting to see more wild discus sort of being imported around the world. But in general, I think that's the big thing with them. Discus are susceptible to disease. Many populations of discus, you know, are found in the wild, and not always, but tend to be in more acidic conditions. And they sort of are not exposed to a lot of different types of bacteria in those sort of systems. And so they can be susceptible to things. But once a discus is acclimated into your current water, you know, they can be very hardy. So when I say, are they for beginners? You know, I would say if you're getting them from a really reputable source, whether it be wild or captive bred, I think that they can be very, very rewarding fish and fairly easy to take care of. I think the biggest thing I can give you is that they can be susceptible to disease. So I think quarantine of tank mates and new discus are really important.
With regard to, I guess, temperatures and you mentioned tank mates, like what should they be ideally kept by themselves, or what type of, you know, fish would you keep them with? And then, temperature has always been kind of a tricky question. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I've seen discus, you know, in the Lago Grande, the discus was, you know, in the low 70s there. And a lot of the places, you know, the water's probably in the 80s, and some places it might be in the upper 80s. You know, so it ranges in the wild of what discus. Now, I know the one exporter that, you know, I spent a lot of time with, his fish tend to be warm, and all his fish, when they whether they're found in a cooler water or not, seem to do really well in high temperatures water. High temperatures can also be sort of a wall to a vector for various diseases. You know, discus can take it pretty high. They can take it up to like 88 degrees. I believe a lot of the aquaculture discus tend to be raised in a lot more warmer water environments. But in general, you know, I would say I keep my discus, if I'm keeping them with other fish, I'm keeping them, or in planet tanks, I'm keeping them around 80 to 82. If I'm keeping them by themselves, I tend to keep them around 84 to 85. If they seem to, if they're new discus that I'm getting in, I'm quarantining them, I'll tend to keep the temperature a little bit above 80. But I think in general, it can definitely, you know, they can be highly variable, you know.
Okay. And then nutrition-wise, wild caught's pretty easy to acclimate to kind of prepare diets, or what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, I asked, you know, when I first met Victor at Santidum Discus, I asked, what are you feeding your discus? And he goes, oh, in the Amazon, it's hard to get good food, but, you know, I'm using this brand of flake food. And all at the time I visited him, all he was feeding his fish was flake food.
Okay. And they were going for it, at least, you know, if it's not necessarily ideal, they're still eating it.
Oh, they were devouring it. And these fish were looking amazing on flake food. That was when I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing. You know, I mean, it was just there. He used to have, I think, a geophagus in the tank because he would feed him heavily. Discus, you know, they need to eat. So you want to make sure you feed your discus 3+ times a day, ideally, especially if they're younger discus.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if it's warmer, I'm assuming the metabolism's going up as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. But I mean, in captivity, I feel that pet foods in general, including fish foods, have really made great strides in the past 20 years. And I think there's a lot of really good fish foods available on the market. When I was younger, I used to do blackworms. Now the trade in blackworms just seems, supply seems to go in and out, and the prices have skyrocketed. But I do, you know, give my discus. And I guess I'd ask you the question: is how nutritious are freeze dried foods or dehydrated foods?
I mean, I would think the dehydrated freeze dried. I mean, they can be nutritional. You know, we usually talk about, as you know. Just kind of a mix, just to try to not put all your eggs in one basket regard to nutrition. But yeah, I mean, it definitely probably as a supplement, you know, it probably could be pretty good. The fresh stuff is always good. And if like you mentioned there, I agree, there's a lot better high quality kind of a nutritional, you know, commercial diets now. So that does help.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what I've been seeing a lot with my discus is I give them, you know, mainly pellets and flakes, and then I give them frozen and the dehydrated foods as sort of a supplement. You know, I really like giving discus mysa shrimp. Discus seem to like bloodworms. I'm not certain how nutritional bloodworms are. That's another question for you, I guess.
Maybe. I think they have some value. Again, I'm definitely not a nutritionist, but yeah, I always kind of go with the fresh is good, really good quality commercial is great, and then, you know, just everything in moderation and, you know, a good mix. But that, yeah, definitely good questions.
I think with a high quality pellet and flake food, I think, you know, even if you just do the pellets, there's some just great foods out there. There's a lot of different brands that are doing a great job. And, you know, with the discus, a higher protein food is what I think is really important for them. And, you know, multiple feedings a day is they just need to eat. You know, I see a lot of discus in captivity that whether they're wild or captive, that are just not being fed at the level that they need, and they're just skinny.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, we're getting close to the end. I did have one more quick question before we close up. And what's your thoughts on, I guess, kind of numbers and sex ratios in a tank?
I really like to, you know, for an average home aquarium, I like to say, you know, one adult discus, you know, that's 4 to 6 inches per every 8 to 10 gallons of water. Yes. Do people keep them in higher concentrations than that? Yes. But remember, when you are keeping discus in such high concentrations, you have to feed them. You have to do consistent water changes. Water quality is very important with discus. You know, big water changes frequently are really important to have happy, healthy discus.
Any issues with like males or females, or you have to worry about that?
They will pair off and they can create a territory. Now, I did visit a discus breeder this year and he had like in a 125 gallon tank, I think he had like six. He had multiple breeding pairs and multiple of them were spawning in their little section. But, you know, discus can be a little bit difficult to sex, but, you know, keeping them in pairs or probably, you know, sort of the best price, similar to what you would do with angelfish, you know?
Okay. Sounds good. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I definitely want to thank our guest, Kapil Mandrekar, and our producer, Mark Winter, for making the show possible. So as I always kind of like to ask, do you have any final words of wisdom or thoughts for our listeners?
Well, with wild discus, I will say that they definitely have a personality. That's what really got me back into discus. I'd kind of gotten out of discus for a while. It was an aquarium importer in the U.S. that sent me a video of one of her wild discus beating up a pike cichlid. And that got my attention. I've sort of dug into just the variety and where these fish live. And there's just some exciting wild discus. Also, again, when you buy wild discus, you also are supporting, you know, local communities. You know, and if you choose to get aquaculture discus, that's perfectly fine. There's a lot of great aquaculture farms that support the demand for, you know, for discus fish in the country, but don't buy aquaculture discus if you think that's, you know, the more environmental aspect of it. You know, if you think wild collecting discus is bad for the environment, it's not the case. You know, one last story I'll leave you with is in the town of Curipera, where these really red discus came from, a storm came through and basically totaled their school. And it was the Santanum discus. He actually built them a new school, you know, because there is this partnership between them that they depend on each other. And so if their communities is hurt, so that means the exporters are also hurt. So you see the money going back to these communities, as well as, you know, he sort of acts as like the guy that handles conflict. And it was pretty awesome to see him wear his many hats with these communities. But, you know, there's a strong relationship between these exporters and these communities, and they take care of each other. So that's pretty awesome.
No, that's great. Definitely a great ending and kind of reminder for folks that there is a lot of good sustainable collection out there. And I kind of did appreciate your, which makes a lot of sense, the fact in the early days where we were not getting maybe the nicest discus because we didn't want to pay that much back in the day. So
they weren't being shipped properly. So when they would come,
yeah, that's right,
be in the shop, they'd just be black or brown, whatever, you know. And that's the other thing with wild discus is they take a little bit longer to color up in your tank. But when they do color up, it's pretty amazing. And you get just the variety of colors that you do in captive strains, you know.
Very cool. Well, thanks again. And I really appreciate your taking your time, Kapil. And we'll talk to you a lot more, I'm sure, in the future. Please be sure to check out Kapil's web links found on his Aquarium Mania episode page. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, email me at drroy@petliferadio.com. That's DRROY @petliferadio.com. Until next time, please visit your local aquarium stores and keep your tanks clean and your fish healthy. And definitely think about discus for your next tank.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.